Call the Joint Interim Special Committee on University Governance and Operations to order, please, for January 17th, 2014. Welcome, members. Welcome all who are here. Please take a moment to make sure your cell phones are not going to ring. We have an information. I'm going to open up an informational meeting. We are going to first discuss shared services. Second, we'll discuss the proposed governance proposal by the true presidents. And members, my hope is that we'll take this opportunity to review the work that's been done on shared services in the report, give you the opportunity to ask any questions that you might have on that approach to shared services that the seven universities have brought forward. A goal for this hearing is hopefully that by the end of this hearing, you'll be clear on the proposed approach to shared services and ready to give either input to Senator Girard and myself that you are in support of that approach or that you still have questions, and we'll try to figure out what exactly other information you need to resolve those questions. On the governance issue, similar, there'll be no motion today before this committee on governance. At least the goal I have for the hearing today is that the true president's proposal be as vetted as thoroughly as possible, that any questions you have on their proposal be presented, and again, similarly, perhaps not necessarily in today's hearing, but sometime in the near future, it would be good to get feedback from each one of you on your concerns and or support of the president's proposal. There will be time for discussion after the presentations, and we welcome your comments, your thoughts on this issue. With that as the framework, I'm going to send it over to Eastern Oregon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Buckley. Thank you, Co-Chair Senator Girard. For the record, my name is Bob Davies. I have the pleasure of serving as the president for Eastern Oregon University. I'm also joined today to assist me in this presentation by the bionic man, Jay Kenton. Do you want to say something for the record so we do everything okay, Richard?
I can do that if I add any commentary.
So okay.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Buckley, you've just given me a ominous charge to bring clarity to shared services.
Yes.
I will do everything I can humanly to attempt to do that because this is a very complex issue. There has been significant amount of work regarding the implementation of institutional boards and how to manage the shared services. As Senate Bill 270, as you know, set forward a charge to the presidents of the seven universities to work together to come up with a plan, to come up with suggestions for this board, for this this committee on how we would manage shared services. That, just as they bring clarity, was an ominous charge. And when it was brought to us months ago, we took it with a great deal of zeal and a great deal of zest. I would also have to say with a great deal of trepidation, because each of our universities, each of our presidents, we are guided to represent our university. We are guided to make sure that our university is represented in full force. What we were able to do, however, is put the state first, put the needs of our Oregonians and our citizens and our students first. And I'm very, very pleased that all seven presidents worked very diligently together, that we worked hard and put away some of our differences, and at the end of the day presented you with a proposal that you've all, I'm sure, read line by line, that represents the collective wisdom of the seven universities. I will say from the outset that not everything in this proposal is what we would all 100% want for our institution, but it is the best compromise that seven leaders can come together and to make. I would also want to articulate that being presidents and good leaders, we delegated a great deal of this work to our vice presidents. They did an amazing job, and again, taking that same charge as the presidents did in putting away their own specific agenda items and saying what is the best for Oregonians, what is the best for the overall system. And in doing so, yes, we did come up with a proposal that we believe works. It meets the basic needs of all of our institutions. Sure, there's little parts in it here and there that each of us disagree with, but again, the litmus test that we had at the end of the day was very simple. Does this, if everything in this report, can we live with? And each of the presidents, each of the vice presidents, each of the universities said, yes, everything in here we can live with. So with that, I would also like to publicly thank Ed Ray, who co-chaired the work with me. He's unable to attend today. He's attending to other duties, but he was an enormous help in his leadership in this process as well, as was Jay Kenton and Charles from the system office and others as well. So again, thank you very much. Going through the recommendations, one of the very first items that you asked us to opine on is what should the structure be. When we came back and gave an interim report back in November or whatnot, it was very interesting because at that time we were talking about a separate entity and a separate board and the like. And it was either I'm dying or the lights are going.
A little bit of both.
Thank you so much.
On that note,
For the record, Regoop, you made a president lose his
I'm sorry, my apologies.
But one of the things that we talked about at the previous interim session was that having a separate board for this body. And it was very interesting because we received quite a few comments by then-member Senator Courtney, in fact, about do we really need to have a separate board. And we took that charge back, and we have developed a way in which we don't need a separate board. We don't need to have a separate legal entity. The way that we will manage through the this is the hiring of an executive director that will oversee the entire shared service enterprise. We are in the midst of right now of working with the lawyers and the vice presidents of finance in developing master contracts to guide shared services as a whole. And then each of the shared services in of itself will also have contracts that will bind the members of the shared service and the work of the shared service as we move forward. So we are not creating another layer of bureaucracy. We are not creating another entity that needs to be governed. We are providing something that is very, very nimble and that will be able to meet the needs of our work. Speaking of the shared services, one of the things that Representative Whitsitt talked very eloquently about is what are those services that are necessary. We've devised or come up with seven shared services that are necessary for our universities to have. They include employees' benefits, risk management, and collective bargaining. Those three items are written into Senate Bill 270 as mandatory for all seven universities to participate in. We've also added accounting, the fifth site computer operations, payroll processing, and treasury operations. All of those are pretty self-explanatory with the exception of the fifth site. What the fifth site is very quickly is it is operated at the Oregon State University, and it is the backbone of the computer system and information systems for the four technical and regional universities. Thus the fifth site. Candidates that we did talk a lot about, but we felt that were not necessarily part of the shared service enterprise because they relate directly to the governance model of each institution, and these areas need to report to the governing board of those institutions. That includes fiscal monitoring, internal audit services, external audit services, legal services, and government advocacy. We also talked a great deal about some of the other services that are currently conducted by the Chancellor's Office that may or may not be candidates for shared services and work, and those include student services, academic services, and the like. We did not put those in the primary ones because each university may enter into its own agreements with other partnerships on a case-by-case basis to have those go forward. But again, the seven primary ones will be operated by the executive director. The other ones that we talked about would be operated by each individual institution in relationship to their governance model. Regarding the seven ones that I mentioned, as part of the enterprise, the operations will be housed at two universities. Oregon State will be housing all of the shared services at their particular site, university, with the exception of employee benefits, which will be housed at the University of Oregon. The reason for that is because right now, through the Chancellor's offices, that is where those individuals currently reside. And so, again, we're not interested in moving people around or creating additional chaos. What we're using the assets benefits that are already in place. And again, U of O will house the employee benefits. Oregon State will house the other six operations. Again, this is the most effective way to achieve that. It's also important to note that the employees of the shared service enterprise will report directly to the executive director. They will be employees of their particular university where they're located. So, for example, at Oregon State, in risk management, the individual will be an Oregon State employee, but their policies, their employment work, their direction will be given from the executive director, who will be employed by the president's council, the seven presidents working together, and he or she will report directly to that president's council and therefore would not be an employee of one of those institutions. To the right is the institutional participants in each of those search services. I know this will cause a robust discussion by Senator Girard, but we can continue on and have that question afterward if that's okay. The next one was a recommendation, or part of our charge, was to talk about the total cost impact with regards to the dismantling or the disbundling of the shared services. This chart talks about and displays that as accurately and best as we can. It is a very complex enterprise that we are working on, and there's a lot of nuances to that. And so this chart is the best way we are able to capture that element. Under the first column, sources of resources, assessments and budget, each university pays into the shared service model currently through the chancellor's office. Each university pays a tax on auxiliaries and also a tax on indirect cost recovery. The numbers right next to that demonstrate what that source of income is. So, for example, my institution pays approximately $1.2 million into the shared service enterprise. OIT pays just under $1 million, and et cetera. Again, that is based on a taxing system or an allocation system made up of auxiliary services and also indirect cost recovery. This chart does not include the number of the dollars that are contributed are put in by the chancellor's office, which is roughly $4.8 million to that level. So, again, if you add all those up, that does not give you the true cost of the shared service enterprise. It would be short by what the chancellor's office puts in it, which is, again, $4.8 million, which comes from a state appropriation. The next column, the shared services estimated cost. This is the amount of usage, if you will, by each of the institutions. On many of the shared services, it is either conducted by it as a direct cost to that institution or the direct allocation of what that institution uses from that shared service, or it's based on a formula. For example, PEB is based on a formula that was given to us, and so it's not the direct cost associated with that shared service, but a formula-driven algorithm. Other ones would be on a direct cost basis. But again, for example, EOU puts in $1.2 million. The cost to support the services for Eastern is $1.4 million. And then you go down the line and you could calculate that out. The third item, or the third column, is the additional cost that will be expected by each university, regardless of governance in many cases, of the services that are not included in the shared services. For example, under the true universities, you see $248,300. What this is in relation to, for example, is the extra institutional research that will be required that is currently being conducted by the chancellor's office, but as it removes its services, will need to be picked up. Capital construction, contracting support, fixed cost allocations, and those type of things. This is regardless of what governance model is chosen by the truths or what the governance model is provided to the truths. These are the additional costs that we will have to absorb. There are some additional costs, depending upon which structure we would go to, that will be in addition to that. For example, internal audit, legal, and et cetera. So that is a $258,000 or thereabouts hard cost that the truths will be picking up based on this effort. The numbers for Oregon State, Portland State, and the University of Oregon include those numbers, but also their cost of governance. So again, they were able to provide what it will cost them to provide those services and whatnot. And the last column is a very simple one. It's column A minus column B minus column C. What is the net change in cost for the institutions? For Eastern, it's $484,000and whatnot. In total, for the true universities, we are talking about a $1.9 million change, and for the larger institutions is about 2.3, so the total number is about $4.3 million based on the changes of shared services and the implementation of governing boards. One of the key discussion points is how do we mitigate those changes? And this is where we get into the meat of the report and recommendations. The committee, again, made these recommendations through a consensus process. We all agree to these. We all support these. Again, these recommendations are presented in priority order. They represent the collective wisdom and compromise of the institutions. So regarding the addressing the $1.9 million that the TRUES that I just mentioned, using funds, the first recommendation is using funds that is currently allocated to the Chancellor's office from operations and have that offset those costs. Two, another opportunity would be the reductions to the appropriations for the larger universities necessary to offset those impacts. And then three, seek additional state funding. We're university presidents. We always ask for money. We also know that that's the third recommendation for a reason.
It's prioritized well.
Understood. We also are regarding the addressing of the 1.2 annual impact on the universities without their own governing boards associated with the unbundling of PEB composite rates. As we discussed last time, several of the universities, Eastern being one of them, due to where we live, due to our risk pool of our faculty and staff, we have more married couples, so the cost is, or married individuals, so the cost is higher as compared to, example, for those at Portland State, where they also have that much more access readily to hospitals and whatnot. One is to adjust the rate so each university pays its respective amount and redress the impacts by seeking and obtaining additional state general fund dollars and providing such additional resources to the TRUES. Our number two, leave the composite rate as is, but reallocate existing state general fund dollars to the largest to address this issue. The next report recommendation is regarding addressing the 1.6 annual impact associated with the pooled student building fee. As I mentioned in our report before, right now the students of each of the seven universities, pay $45 every term to a building student fund. This is started in the 1960s, and what it allows for is the bonding capacity for buildings that are student fee supported, i.e., student union buildings and the like. There were very specific decisions made with this pool in mind. For example, at Eastern, we risk renovated our student union utilizing these funds. There are bond and debt obligations that have been committed, and that we, as we unbundle this with the larger institutions leaving the system, they'll be leaving the pool business, the pooled student building fee, that we need to redress those funds. Jay has forecasted all of the work out. There is enough money in the reserves to pay all of the debts off as we move forward, and with our recommendation is to use the accumulated cash reserves annually to fund those bonds and debt service shortfalls, and once all the debts are paid off, there will be some money left over, and to divide those funds up according to an algorithm on student headcounts and provide that back to Portland State, Oregon State, and the University of Oregon. The second one would be is to use an agreed upon our calculation projection methodology hold only that portion of the reserve that is needed to fund and give the funds out now. Again, I think it's more important that we hold the funds in reserve because student enrollment fluctuations could have a significant impact on that, and we want to make sure that we do not violate any of the covenants.
Yes, hold on.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And thank you all for having me. I'm new to the conversation, so if I asked questions that have been answered previously, just tell me to stop talking. My question is whether or not the students have a preference between these two recommendations, or if they were consulted.
I can answer that from one perspective, and we do have some students from Portland State in the audience, and I'd be more than happy to defer to them as well. At one of the Oregon State Student Association meetings, I brought this issue up and talked with the students in a frank, albeit very brief discussion, and it was that we need to hold the decisions hold harmless now, pay off the debts, but not to continue to collect the funds and whatnot. Jay, do you have any other comments on that?
Yeah, co-chairs Gerard and Buckley. For the record, Jay Kenton, Vice Chancellor of Finance at the Oregon University System, and Representative Williamson. We haven't actually talked to the students, but I will tell you the Treasury and the Department of Justice do have a preference, and it is our first recommendation. I mean, they want to make sure these bonds get repaid. In many ways, what has happened here is the smaller schools have received more bonds than what their revenues will pay for, and there's a shortfall of about $1.6 million next year, and it varies each year as bonds get repaid, etc. And you know, this would ensure that, you know, we hold those monies. And I'm sure from a larger school perspective, the students may feel, well, we could use those excess funds for other things, but yet the spirit of this by statute, and actually it was created prior to 1960, was a shared building fee pool. And everybody knew, I think, at least during my 30-year tenure in the system, that there was allocations going on that meant there were subsidies, if you will, back and forth, and we're honoring those. But we haven't asked. I have approached OSA and asked them directly if they had a preference, and I did that probably 2 or 3 months ago. I have not heard back from them, so my sense is they either couldn't come to consensus or they've had other issues that they haven't had a time to deal with it.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. And my apologies for not welcoming you to the committee. Thank you for joining us.
I feel very welcomed.
I'm very, very
thank
glad.
You.
Welcome. Officially,
please.
Proceed. All right. The student building fee fund, NPEP, is a very interesting and complex one, and it does bring up some very philosophical notions of spreading cost over and realizing that when doing so, you're always going to have quote-unquote winners and losers. You're going to have one institution or one body that's going to overpay, and another one's going to underpay, and at the end of the day, you're making sausage and it all works out. So, again, it's a very interesting philosophical discussion. Moving on, we in this report have addressed all of the things that we know given today. There's a lot of ambiguity. There's a lot of different changes that can occur and will occur over the next year, 2 years, and whatnot. And what we've tried to do is put in place a system and a formula and a benchmarking process or a fundamental foundation point to move forward on. We cannot account for every single nuance and every single change. As universities come in and out of the shared services, as we operate the shared services, we hope that could lead to the possibility of other universities and community colleges participating and changing cost structures and those type of things. What we tried to do is account for everything that we know at this particular time and in moving forward on that. You know, one of the discussion points is in Senate Bill 270, as duly noted, that there is language that if an there is mitigating language for institutions that do not choose to have a governing board. We do not know where the technical and regional universities will be in the near future on that very notion. One of the other recommendations that we were asked to opine on was, in fact, should all shared services be mandatory and whatnot? And we wrestled with this mightily. And what we came down on is the idea of market forces. What we believe in and what we wholeheartedly agree to is that the shared service model should be based on value. It should be based on providing the best service possible at the lowest cost possible. And so if we're able to create value, if we're able to create those services that are meaningful to the universities and that are what we're needed, and at that price, the universities will stay in them. So, Senator Rod, we will convince the university to come back in with us, I promise. I shouldn't promise, political promise. But we want to have these services of value. And so making them mandatory, in some respects, loses that incentive to be of value, to always be looking at a way to do whatever service it is in a better and more cost-effective way. And so another reason, again, with having the executive director report to the president's organizational body or their designees, is to hold that individual accountable for providing that value, in which he or she will also work down and have the employees report to them up and having, again, that market advantage, if you will, through this process. Next steps, as mentioned, we're determining the need for the next steps that we're following is determine the needs for statutory revisions to Senate Bill 270 in the February session to start to implement this. To my knowledge and to Mr. Kenton's knowledge, there's very few issues with regards that are going to be needed legislative advocacy or legislative action. The one item has to do with the Treasury, with the three universities on their own. The commingling of funds and that type of thing is being addressed in the revision of Senate Bill 270. Other than that, we do not see a lot of we do not see any other legislative action that needs to occur. We are contracting with a search firm to recruit the executive director. That individual needs to be in place and ready to go by July 1, 2014, because that's when the shared service enterprise needs to take hold. So we actually need that person before that time. Right now, the legal team, as I mentioned, the lawyers are heavily involved in developing and drafting all of the contracts, the master service agreements for the overall shared enterprise, and then also the specific service agreements for each of the items within. We're also working with the host campuses to transfer outside contracts and making sure that we are set up for there as well. And we're also transitioning the current chancellor's office employees to the appropriate body to perform these duties. A lot of work is continuing and moving forward. Therefore, it would be extremely helpful that if we would at least receive a nod of this is the way to go and to proceed so that we can continue those activities in the good faith that we need to be able to do so. Outstanding issues that we just, time is of the essence. We know on July 1, 14, that we will need to continue to move forward and have this in place. We are diligently working on that. And given the work that has been done and the individuals that we have in place, I am confident that we will be able to do so. With that, I would be more than happy to answer any questions, deflect any concerns to Jay, and have a wonderful dialogue.
Thank you, Mr. Well done. Questions from the committee? It was so clear. I think you've stunned them.
I will have one in just about 1 second.
All right.
Okay. I've got the answer.
Sir Devlin?
What's
that? Devlin, you're limited to 5 minutes, as my co-chair.
Uh-huh.
Good luck on that.
The interesting thing in this is that when you look away from the issue of governance costs and others, at least if my math is correct, because you've looked at your shared services and you've looked at how to perhaps do them more efficiently in some areas, that what you're reporting as your cost per institution for shared services prior to this is greater than what your cost of shared services will be after. Now, by institution, they may be more or less, but your composite costs are lower. If you do the math, unless I've made an error here, it appears you're somewhat over $20 million existing costs of shared services, and somewhere in the neighborhood of let's see, it looks like
3, 4, 5.
Yeah. If you want to comment, Mr. Kenton.
You're looking, excuse me, Co-Chair, Senator.
I'm looking at
you're
the,
looking at this chart.
I'm looking at the first two columns.
Right.
If you were to add the first column, which is the cost of current shared services, and then if you were add the column of second, it is actually lower than the first column. Now, it is higher for some institutions versus others, but it would imply that in some ways, and when you get to the end, the actual cost of this. Now, there may be other things in the third column beyond governance, but and that might vary by institution. And obviously, there's the little caveat down at the bottom that this assumes that the four institutions don't have independent boards. But it does appear that although the cost, again, may be higher to some institutions than others, the net cost overall is lower.
Co-Chair, Senator Devlin, I believe the reason for that, we have historically assessed campuses, as President Davies mentioned, by taking a percentage of their indirect cost recoveries and a percentage of their auxiliary revenues. In addition to that, there's other assessments for risk management that are
right,
kind of allocations of self-insurance premiums, et cetera, that are embedded in that first column. And we never attributed those revenues to shared services. We attributed them to Chancellor's office operations. Those operations include statewide governance functions that span beyond shared services. You know, doing programmatic approvals and all the other various things that we've done over the years. And so it wasn't a one-for-one. But what we determined as we got into this process and started to unbundle the system, if you will, is that we no longer had a basis to charge campuses for that because the OUS no longer has that statewide responsibility. In many ways, it's shifting to the HEC, I believe, or to other bodies, or perhaps it won't happen in the future. I don't know. But and therefore, it's a little bit of apples and oranges, and yeah. I apologize for the confusion, well, but that's been the nature of this. I mean,
the reason I'm bringing up the issue is I'm trying to avoid, I understand the impact on individual institutions now. For some, it might be less and some more. But in terms of the net cost, it does appear to be slightly less, because I'm going to hear from members that are going to say the cost of shared services is going to be significantly higher. Now, it will be higher for some institutions, but not for others. And, of course, you know, it would be good to see what other factors there are in the third column beyond governance in terms of the higher, well, the higher costs for the big three. But I just think it's important to understand that you know, the casual look at this may not be the look that's going to be accurate reflecting this. It's sort of like, I don't want to bring up a sore subject, but when we went through the issue of school districts purchasing their own insurance, and it's a little bit different, from the state standpoint, well, one school district might be able to purchase less, or one be able to purchase, you know, get a better price in the state pool through the Oregon Educators Board, and one would not get as good a price. The ultimate was, what was the bottom line for the state?
Sure.
What was the ultimate bill to the state? Because on the school side in particular, maybe not on the higher education side as by far as much, the ultimate bill still comes to Salem.
Understood. Co-Chair Buckley, Co-Chair Gerard, Senator Devlin, I think you make an astute point, and as Professor Kenton mentions, that this is not necessarily apples to oranges. There are certain things within that second column that we will just no longer do. So there are some services that will be ceasing to exist. And one can argue that is that we are being more efficient and effective by determining what we need to do, what we must do, what we would really like to do, and what we need to get out of. And that is also part of the process as well. And so, again, it's not just a direct, yes, you're all of a sudden paying a lot less. Do I think that this model or this enterprise that we're moving forward, will it make us more efficient and effective in especially those services that we've identified as a primary? I really do, because I think of the market forces, because of the opt-in and the value-added propositions. But there are things that will be forced down to the campuses and to the universities that will change a little bit. In the report, Appendix 4 highlights, for example, Column 3 for the True Universities. Craig Morris, the Vice President of Southern Oregon University, is in the audience, and if you'd like to have some specifics on that, we would be more than happy to talk about the $248,000 for the TRUES. Also in the Appendix 4 are the three universities and what they're adding into and the cost structure that they're adding into for their own institutional board. So that information is available for your reading enjoyment.
And just finally, if I may, Co-Chairs and Senator Devlin, if you look, for instance, at U of O number of 1,650,000 in column 3 or 4, however you want to count columns, 900,000 of that is governance, and the balance is them picking up shared services because they're opting out of six or many of those shared services. So I don't think it's a true comparison of shared services, just looking at that second column of the costs.
Thank you very much. Senator Denver, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. And the first is kind of following up on what was just said. So is there an assessment of, for those services that not all the universities are opting into, is the assumption that those institutions will be able to do it at a lower cost than they currently are being assessed for it? I am happy to see that for most, I mean, all of these, there is a certain amount of economy of scale being built in. That's great. But you know, what is going to be the impact on those that choose not to opt in, and more particularly to their students?
Sure. I will attempt to answer that on behalf of the institutions that are opting out. As you notice, Eastern specifically is opting in all of them. I think what their belief is that they will be able to provide that service more dedicated to their specific needs and at a better cost.
Co-chairs, Senator Denbrough, that annual net cost actually is a pretty good indication of incremental costs at those institutions, but it includes the cost of maintaining a governing board, having a separate audit, create an internal audit department, you know, legal services, self-provided legal services, et cetera. And so, you know, this question, determine the financial impact, at the header of this slide came right out of Senate Bill 270, and I tried, or we tried as a group, to answer it as best we could, but it does blend together the governance with the shared service. If you look at the spreadsheet on Appendix 5, which is fairly small print, I realize, in a lot of detail, you should be able to discern, you know, what's shared service, what's self-op, what's governance, et cetera, in those amounts.
If I could follow up. You know, I just, you know, I'd like to see, one of the provisions of Senate Bill 270 is it calls for annual reports to the HEC of those institutions that have governing boards. And I'd like to see, as part of that annual report, just what the cost implications are of the decisions being made by the boards, you know, just to see, you know, the decision to have the own board, the goal is that there are going to be savings there. And, you know, I think it would be useful for us as we analyze this course that we have allowed to be taken, you know, just how is this playing out? I have a couple of other short questions.
You keep going.
Yeah, one has to do with academic services, and, you know, which has been alluded to. And so, you know, some of the cost of the, you know, the higher cost of the TRUs, of the shared administrative services, will presumably be picked up by transfers from the chancellor's office, where the work is being done now. That makes a lot of sense. But that does not include the administrative kind of work that the chancellor's office already also does. And that presumably would go not to the institutions, but to the HEC. Is that a correct statement?
Co-Chair Girard and Co-Chair Beckley and Senator Denbrough, that is my belief is that those duties will become part of the HEC as part of their statewide strategic planning process and whatnot. With regards to the funding and those type of things, I think that's a decision that is going to be made by others.
We are really committed to having a coordinated academic higher education, if not system. We want the universities to be working closely together on academic strategies, and that would be the role of the HEC, and so the HEC would need that funding to do it, presumably.
I definitely agree that they would need the funding and expertise, the human capital, and the resources to do that. So I would agree with that assessment. How that is functionally done through the legislative and appropriation process.
But that's part of the assumptions behind the finances in this shared services proposal. You're just looking at shared operating.
That is. Yes.
Shared administrative services.
That is right? Correct. It would be presumptuous of me to make a budget for the HEC.
Great. If it's a good one, you know, we would listen to it.
I could. I'll work on that on my day job.
My third question goes back to the PEB. And the, you know, there is an assumption that a change will have to happen there, that, you know, either through changing the rates, or through changing allocations to universities, we need to make a change to succeed the new governance structure. Are we really required to do that? I mean, you know, I think it seems to me that, you know, there's also a lot of value in spreading the risk and, you know, looking at the universities still in terms of a composite rate.
Co-Chair Buckley, Co-Chair Girard, and Senator Denbrough, I think that's an excellent question. I think that given the independent nature of what is being put forward, that is something almost like what is needed to be done with the Treasury would need to be part of the Senate Bill 270 omnibus bill that is moving forward. Jay, do you have any?
Co-Chair Senator Denbrough, we have assumed that, you know, we've created three new legal entities, and each of those legal entities would pay its bills, if you will, for its population. And this is something that Representative Buckley and I have talked a lot about. In the legislation, it is clear, because it's a mandatory shared service required until June 30th of 2015, that we will continue to do what we have historically done, which is look at the 13,000 OUS PEB-eligible employees as one body and come up with a composite rate. But as we break up our payrolls and everybody's doing their own payroll, that's going to require that U of O and PSU assess their employees at a higher rate than their actual costs and transfer monies to OUS or some clearinghouse to distribute to the other institutions that are on the, you know, the short end of that equation. And I'm assuming PEB is going to deal with each of the universities as a separate billing, a separate legal entity that it needs to bill, you know, and collect premiums from. And I don't know a way how, you know, short of statutory requirement, that how we would continue to have that composite rate.
Senator Devlin, please.
That's fine, actually. I mean, but I would assume whether it's where the Board of Higher Education still exists or whether it's the HEC, in terms of when they ultimately determine the allocation of funds, mm-hmm. they will take into consideration the costs to those institutions. I mean, this body takes that into consideration all the time in terms of what is actually the cost of providing services. And it varies from entity to entity. It varies even within similar entities. So I would assume that the HEC would take that into consideration in their ultimate distribution of funds.
Well, co-chairs, Senator Denbrough, I don't disagree. And that is, in fact, our recommendation, if, you know, as President Davies cited it earlier.
Very good. Additional questions? Mr. Henry, do you have anything?
No, it's really interesting to track, especially since even the PEB question affects me personally. But my only question is, as we phase this in, how does this reorganization and realignment, in terms of what we've heard today, really affect the overall goals of 40-40-20? Are we in fact changing a structure that will make a difference in terms of that? Will the students of our respective universities benefit from the change here?
Which that's a almost rhetorical question. If you'd like to respond, though, you'd be welcome to.
It is. I think it's an excellent question. It's the question that I know I personally, and I think that especially in working with my colleagues, we ask ourselves every single day: is how are we making a difference in moving the needle on 40-40-20? I think this shared service enterprise that we are talking about today is a byproduct of Senate Bill 270. I think it is an extremely creative approach, utilizing existing resources as best as possible and becoming more innovative. I actually think that this model may be looked upon by other states as a way to go. Do I think that the shared service enterprise, as we talked about today, will magically move the needle for 40-40-20? No, it won't. I think this is behind, this is inside baseball, this is behind the curtains and everything else. I do believe that the overall discussion with regards to the structure of universities, in institutional boards, consortium boards, branches, all these other types of things. That is the fundamental question, is how are we moving the needle for 40-40-20? How do we impact the lives of our students on our campuses today? More importantly, how do we impact the lives of the students who will join our campuses in the next year, the next decade, the next score to come? And I think it's imperative that we take very, very an aggressive look at that, especially for the true universities, in the way that we are governed, the way that we relate to the state, the way that we relate to statewide goals and objectives, the way that we are able to maintain our costs by being affordable, and also making sure that we remain accessible. The shared service enterprise, from that perspective, is a major influence. Because if we do not address this and do not address this right, the skyrocketing cost to the true universities will be phenomenal, and that will be passed on to the students. The plan and the system and the proposal that we put forward holds those costs equal, holds those costs at a level in which I do not believe we will need to pass those on to our students. And as we talk about in the next open session or the next work session, governance models for the true universities, I think we've developed, again, a very creative approach to ensuring that the technical and regional universities will be able to continue to meet the statewide approach, will be able to work with the shared services in meeting our goals and ambitions. So very, very good rhetorical question.
And very, very good answer as well. Chair Donegan.
Thank you, Co-Chair Buckley and Gerard, members of the committee. I just, this is the second time I've seen this report now in the last week, and had the benefit of reviewing this with the Board of Higher Ed, and I just want to share the reviews from the Board of Higher Ed. Just outstanding work from Bob and from Jay, the Chancellor's Office, in an incredibly short amount of time. I think this project really stands apart in my time in higher ed as being just an outstanding piece of work. And just as a reminder, it wasn't very long ago that as we were considering decentralization and looking at U of O and PSU and OSU getting their own local boards and all the benefits of decentralization, one of the big concerns was, oh boy, what about the economies of scale that we could lose? And somebody just, you know, identified, well, we better work out shared services. And from that very high-level identification of need, your group has just done a wonderful job of really drilling down in a short amount of time. And I agree, it's extremely innovative, and it could be a model that would be adopted elsewhere. So just and then to Sam, to your question, I think the upside here, if this really performs, I mean, this could really accrue a lot of value to the students and address a lot of the pressures that students are facing in terms of costs. I mean, this could grow to be an enterprise that serves community colleges and other institutions, lowering unit costs, and all of that will benefit our students. I mean, so I think this is very exciting. And then further, it's just the success that we're seeing, I mean, it's obviously preliminary, I think does lend extra flexibility, if you will, on the further governance issue, which we're about to take up next hour, which is, to the extent you really achieve this, I think it enables a closer look at further decentralization.
Thank you, Mr. Duncan.
Thank you.
Members, unless there's further discussion or questions on shared services, I would like to segue to the governance issue before we do, and this is not a formal vote, but as both President Davies has indicated, there are bills in both the Senate and the House that can be used as needed on the shared services issue, their governance issue, either one. Is there concern from any committee members? I'm not asking you to pledge support for anything right now, but is there a concern that would in any way keep us from working forward in this direction, or is the sense of this committee that this is a good direction to pursue as we continue the discussions into February? Is there any concern that anyone would like to express at this point? And not seeing that concern, then President Davies, this is the nod of the head of our committee that this work should continue. And I share Mr. Dongan's comments and just respect and gratitude. And I think I've said this before. I never expected this to get accomplished because I know how difficult it is. Heck, you know, I work with people that I have to get agreement from all the time, and the fact that all seven institutions were able to do this is really to the credit of all involved. So congratulations for doing so.
Well, thank you, Chair Buckley. Thank you, Chair Girard, for those comments, and thank you very much, Matt, for your comments as well. I am happy to receive those accolations, but six other individuals, six other presidents worked very, very closely on that. Mary Cohen, and the Senate President of Southern, is with us today, too. She worked very, very hard on these efforts. It was a group effort. So, again, I appreciate all of your support. I appreciate the nod. We will continue to deliver for our students. So thank you very much.
Thank you. At this point, I'd like to move on to an informational hearing on the governance issue and the proposal by the two presidents. And I'd like to invite the president of Western Oregon.
Yes, as Mark Weiss, the president of Western, comes forward, we have the pleasure today to present what we have anecdotally called the hybrid approach. I officially now will no longer use the hybrid model. I learned yesterday that the liquor stores and grocery stores are presenting the hybrid model, and I don't want to be associated with whiskey going next to lettuce. So we are presenting the true governance model, and Mark Weiss will provide a PowerPoint presentation about the model itself, and then I will conclude with some remarks to talk about how we work forward on 40-40-20. So, President Weiss.
Honorable chairs and members of the committee, my name is Mark Weiss. I'm president of Western Oregon University, and I thank you for inviting us, the true school presidents, to address you today on governance. The plan for the day, or for the next whatever time we have remaining, is first for me to review the slides that were prepared for the special committee of the House State Board for the State Board of Education on governance shared with them in December, and we've had quite a bit of dialogue among the two school presidents with the special committee, and then President Davies will offer some additional comments. What I'd like to do is leave plenty of time for some dialogue and questions. So I will go through these rather quickly with some prefatory remarks. And I'd like to start by acknowledging and thanking the great leadership of for higher education from our governor, from the Oregon State Board of Higher Education, from the Oregon University system during this time of certainly uncertainty, and for you as legislators for talking about the issues on hand and taking them very seriously. As you know, Senate Bill 270 provides for a period of time from March 1st, 2014, as it now stands, through June 30th, 2015, for any of the true technical and regional universities to request independent boards. And the strategy for that request at the State Board of Higher Education is to come up with a business plan that indicates fiscal sustainability and value to the state for 40-40-20 and an educated Oregon citizenry. Today, I'd like to address the value proposition that we true presidents have prepared. We understand that centralized funding and programmatic approval will now be the responsibility of the Higher Education Coordinating Committee, so that's no longer an issue. We believe that the seven presidents have addressed a framework for shared services that we've just heard about. Perhaps there's some additional clarification and a discussion necessary on that to talk about the question that Senator Devlin had about holding harmless some of the institutions, perhaps. But that will also adequately be addressed, I'm certain. And we believe that our true proposal for governance, collaboration, and statewide advocacy is the path for achieving the goals of our educated Oregon citizenry and for the success of each of our unique student bodies and future Oregonians attending our institutions. Now, to quickly go through the slideshow. Got it. This one right here. So, you know, you can read through these very quickly, as can I. I'd make a couple of comments perhaps on each page. 40-40-20, the capacity for growth to achieve 40-40-20 in the state of Oregon exists in large part because of the capacity, I believe, at the true universities. In large part, the mission of each of the true universities, that is, the success of the rural and underserved populations, particularly in the undergraduate ranks, are extremely important, part of our mission and part of the major reason why we succeed. Additionally, we have major economic, we are major economic engines in our communities, in very rural communities, where we are typically the, if not the largest employer, among the largest employers. And each one of us have a strong conviction to and are all actively involved in the collaborations with Oregon universities, other Oregon universities, community colleges, and K through 12. In the case of OIT, it's, Eastern Oregon University, it's the Promise. In the case of Southern, it's collaboration with the local community college in Medford. In the case of Western, it's partnerships with both high school, school districts, and Chemeketa Community College, and so forth. This is important in getting our students to graduate from high school and to get them into college and through college. Okay. We believe it's essential to collaborate, sharing services for continuous improvement of each of our institutions, to improve our cost structures as we move forward. That's something that we do at Western all the time, continuous improvement. We're each committed to maintaining financial viability and sustainability, and we all have prepared 5-year business plans, at a minimum 5 years, that lead to assure continuous fiscal sustainability for each of our institutions. That's been reviewed with the Special Committee of the State Board of Higher Education. We've gotten some comments back, and some of us are, in fact, adjusting our forecasts and working them even harder to reflect some of the commentary we've received. To coin a cliche often used, let form follow substance. And we recommend a structure for governance for the true institutions that provides strong connections to our respective institutions for institutional success, which in fact means student success at each of our universities. Again, strong partnerships among our four true institutions is critical to our success. What we do at the four institutions is we individualize support for our respective students so that we succeed in our missions at our universities. Our consensus for the best institutional outcomes, consistent with current legislation, is that each technical and regional university is governed by its own board of trustees, as provided by current legislation. And we view the structure of the governing boards of each of those universities as currently provided in legislation for the three large universities. President's Council. Representative Buckley, I did listen to your presentation here a day or two ago to the Higher Education Committee, and actually it was quite good. I enjoyed it very much, and in fact we could have replayed it today and it would have given us a good indication of where we are. And that is, there are a few differences, and I'd like to point them out. So with regard to, you use the word hybrid model quite a bit, and I also would like to not call it a hybrid model, because I'm not sure what it's a hybrid of, but it for sure what it is it's also a collaboration of the presidents of each of the four schools, if not the presidents of other schools, to collaborate in ways that add value to the students and the student experience. Part of this is still in development, but the President's Council is composed at a minimum of the four true presidents. We've each committed to making that happen, and perhaps even adding a member of the individual regional boards, or local boards, rather, to participate. We don't see this as being a legal entity, a governing entity, or even a staffed entity. We don't see this as involving additional cost. We see this as an opportunity to get together, share best practices, share ways to collaborate even better, and also advocate for the agenda of what's best for the TRUs, the technical and regional universities. Again, I think we still have a little bit of discussion in this area as to how this works. And in fact, if we are granted the ability down the road of having our own regional or local boards, I think our boards would also have some interest in being involved in what the function and form of this President's Council looks like. The benefits of this model is that it establishes four separate boards around the state that are knowledgeable and passionate about the true missions of each institution, that know the institution, that know the mission, understand the students, and can do what's best along with the management team at each university to make it happen. It provides a greater number of voices for true support statewide, and it provides opportunities for lower costs through true shared services with structured oversight by presidents and boards. One of the things that was just mentioned, for example, was, well, the cost of internal audit was viewed as a governance function, not a shared service. Well, do each of the four schools set up their own independent internal audit departments, or perhaps we have a small internal audit department that's shared among the four schools, or perhaps do we rely on the state auditors? So there's those kinds of discussions that need to occur and can occur.
I think we took that one out.
Oh, you took it out. Well, the next slide that I have, and I don't like it either, because but it does say, it says drawbacks of this model. And I think it's important to talk about, rather, not the drawbacks, because in my opinion it has none, but it has some challenges. So there's challenges to this model for success, and they have to do with truly the additional training of new boards, like the large schools, the greater time commitment of presidents to care and nurture the boards, and the additional cost. But I call that not cost, but investment. There's value in having your own board. So that investment will have a payback, I believe, for our students. Getting back to the
to the so you pulled that on.
I did. The magic of the pen.
Okay, so I'm not sure where I am. Shared services. Okay, so I'm here. So there's a difference clearly between shared services and governance. That's true for all seven, all four of the TRU institutions and all seven of the state institutions of higher education. President Davies talked quite a bit with Dr. Kenton about shared services. We're talking now about governance, and we think we need to recognize that there indeed is a difference, and I think we all understand that well. So next steps. We're each completing and updating our business plans for by individual institution for the four TRUs, and we each plan to be able to deliver that to the State Board of Higher Education and the Special Committee in February. It will demonstrate for each of us how we plan to be fiscally sustainable for the long term. It will refine the definition of what the President's Council concept is all about. I would personally like to see the involvement of other institutions, perhaps on that President's Council. We will also discuss the governance model with stakeholders in our communities, and both within and without our outside of our universities. And we'll develop, start engaging some discussion with potential board members that might be interested in serving our institutions and working with us, such that we would have a list that we could then provide to the governor for his nomination and legislative approval over the coming months. In summary, the TRU model for each of the institutions provides flexibility, requires collaboration. TRU presidents welcome partnerships and collaborations with all public university, private universities, community colleges, and the K-12 system. The TRU's unique governance, composed of individuals who understand and care passionately about our respective shared missions and strongly are committed to the success of our students and our future students. The TRU model provides additional capacity for achieving the 40-40-20 goal, financial stability, and student success in this new environment of higher education in Oregon. So I thank you very much. I would ask if there were any specific questions for me at this particular point in time, that would be fine. Otherwise, co-chairs, perhaps President Davies would like to finish the commentary.
Senator, please.
Yeah, we've talked about the advantages of having a board, but we have the status quo is right now we have a chancellor and we have a State Board of Higher Ed. Can you tell me why a board is better than even the status quo for the regionals? Because I'm not trying to pick on any universities, but we have one in retrenchment. And when we I'm just trying to see the objectivity if we have problems. And so why is having a state board for every one of the regionals or TRUs, can you compare the advantages to what we have right now? Because I really think that given the timing of this, I think the chancellor's doing a pretty good job. Go ahead.
Well, I agree that the chancellor is doing a good job under very difficult circumstances. No doubt about that, as is the entire Oregon University System Office.
I think the advantages are much like the advantages that were determined just a year and a half ago for the three large universities, where they were given their own governance structures. That is, have a board that focuses in on the mission and goals of its students, and then helps that president and his team succeed, or her team, succeed. The Oregon State Board of Higher Education, I've been attending meetings as president for a few years and before then as vice president of finance at Western, does a great job. But I must say there are some board members, because we have every meeting in Portland, that have never stepped foot on some of these campuses, have never met the students. It's important in my mind. We at Western, for example, we have in total the highest percentage of Oregonians that go to any of the seven institutions. We serve a very large percentage of first-generation and underserved populations. In addition, we serve, like the other TRUs and the other large universities, we serve veterans and non-traditional students who have worked perhaps and want to seek that degree. We think that we can best deliver and get to 40-40-20 through these separate board structures. If, in fact, the State Board of Higher Education and the Oregon University system was deemed not to be the optimal solution in Senate Bill 270, as passed a year and a half ago, then we will. Then we also believe that this is the right thing for a sustainable system of seven universities in Oregon.
Senator Hansel, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Davies, since EOU is in my district, let me direct the question directly to you. And I've heard some chatter at different times along the way as we present. Processed all this, and I'd like for you to maybe respond to it on the record. And that is, do you feel, number one, that you can successfully recruit board members for a regional university, a true university? And then secondly, can you afford a board such as this?
Chair Buckley, Chair Girod, Senator Hansel, thank you very much for that very direct question. And if it is okay, I'd like to also wind that into the astute question asked by Senator Girod, and why is the institutional board appropriate? Because I think they do go hand in hand. To start off that, the first to address your question, first and foremost, can we recruit individuals that will be dedicated to Eastern Oregon University and have the mindset of working with not only our institution, but also meeting the statewide goals? The answer to that is an unequivocal yes. In a recent request from the governor's office through Ben Cannon, we were requested to provide names for replacements at the State Board of Higher Education level as individuals are taking on roles at other universities and going to that institution. We are able to provide a list in very short order of about 25 individuals that have direct experience in leading large organizations. Direct experience, in fact, one of them is a former chair of the State Board of Higher Education. We have other individuals that lead complex organizations, banks, and whatnot. Do we have the capacity throughout Eastern Oregon and Oregon as a whole to meet those requirements? Absolutely. I would also say that that list included some individuals from Idaho, Washington, and Colorado to give a broader perspective. So to answer the question, do we have the capacity of board members? Absolutely. The second question with regards to costing and funding. Again, we've just put forward through the work group being led by Chair Donegan, a financial plan for the next 5 years. It was reviewed by an external audit, external review, PFM, a company. We received the report just yesterday, and we were provided very good feedback that our work and our efforts are right on task. The cost of the investment, as President Wise said, is very important into an institutional board for Eastern because of the dedication and leadership that it will provide. And that investment, I think, will pay off in great sums. So again, as a segue into the question asked by Senator Rod. I've testified in front of this group and along with many other legislative committees, and as also articulated by President Weiss, is that we must have a mechanism in which our structure follows our strategies, and the structure follows what we're trying to achieve. I've also talked a lot about, in various committees, that there is no perfect model. Each one has their strengths and weaknesses, despite that we take it off of the PowerPoint presentation. But each model has their own strengths and weaknesses. And I want to add a third one to that. And none of the governance models, there is no silver bullet. None of the governance models will ensure fiscal sustainability. None of the governance models will ensure that all of a sudden a plethora of students will come to your university. As I look at the environment, as I look at what we've been able to do over the last 5 years of my time, I look at what the State Board has been able to do under the leadership of Chair Donegan and also through the noble work of Chancellor Rose. And it is to have that statewide approach and to have those goals and objectives for each of the universities put forward that will meet the needs of our citizens through the portfolio approach, through the academic strategies programs, through the strategic planning process that the State Board went through and said that we will have higher education throughout the state. We will meet 40-40-20 throughout the state. And if you look at the work specifically from the State Board, we have addressed 40-40-20 in very interesting and progressive ways. And not just the 40 that obtains for a bachelor's degree, but the 44 associate degrees through the immense reverse transfers that we have going forward. And also the 20% in which all of our universities are participating in working with K-12 to increase those levels up. And that is due to leadership. That is due to leadership of Matt Donegan's and chancellors and everyone else. That work will continue through the HEC. And having, as Senator Rod, you mentioned yesterday, of having each individual university report directly to the HEC to hold them accountable, again, that leads to that local control. And again, by having that work done, that element is being taken place. The second component we just talked about, shared services. And again, the universities coming together and presenting and providing a model and a mechanism that will be able to be worked in. And again, even though the presidents are the ones that led that, that was done through a collaborative approach and something that the true university presidents are moving forward on. And the third function that President Weiss also mentioned was the political umbrella and the advocacy and the collaboration. Our President's Council addresses that in a very, very meaningful way, and in a way that I think not only helps us meet the statewide goals, not only helps us meet our individual goals as an institution, but brings in an opportunity for us to continue to offer shared services for our specific elements. Again, continuing to working that out. As I mentioned, there is no model that ensures fiscal sustainability. But when I look at the challenges that I'm facing at my institution, the fiscal challenges that we have in serving 92% of our students are coming to us from the lowest socioeconomic status in the state. First generation at one of the highest. 97% of our students, 97% of our students receive financial aid based on need. We have a model that has the State Board of Higher Education operating at that statewide level. We are facing immense challenges at our local level. What I look forward to is having a group of individuals that will focus in on our specific needs, focus in on the specific challenges that we face, fiscally, academically, connecting to the region, and whatnot. We need a board of individuals that say these are the programs that we need in our region for economic development, for cultural development, for civic development. And having that board that close to the institution will enable us to do that. By being connected through the President's Council, we'll be working together. By being connected directly to the HEC, we'll be able to, again, meet the statewide needs. And so when we say what is the added value, the added value is that expertise that we're able to bring in. The added value is that passion that will be brought forward by these individuals for the success of Eastern Oregon University, and not just for its own success, but in meeting the goals, again, of the entire state. So, yes, do we have the capacity to do that? Absolutely, sir. Yes, we do. Do we have the financing to do that? We will make that happen because, again, the investment is so very, very, very important. We have made significant strides, again, with the help of Chair Donegan and many others in operating our university. But as President Weiss mentioned, getting the board's attention to focus on some of the specific needs has been a challenge. We have dedicated people. The Eastern Promise, I will point out, was started because of a board meeting. But again, having that constant approach, that constant mentorship of a board will make a significant difference for our university, for Southern, for Western, and for Oregon Tech University. So I hope, Senator Hansel, I hope I answered your question. Senator Rod, I hope I answered your question.
Does anyone want to ask? I'm going to go to the House here for a few minutes.
Thank you, President Davies, very much. And I couldn't agree more with your summation of why we need to have boards at each of these universities. Secondly, our community leaders and our students want this for the true universities. And I think that we need to take into consideration what our communities want, and they are the support behind our universities. And so I think that the businesses, the chambers of commerce, I mean, overwhelmingly, I have heard throughout the state that they wish to have the boards, as do the students at the universities. So,
thank you, Representative.
That is correct.
Senator Rudd.
Yeah, back to kind of one of my initial questions, and I love putting people in the hot seat when I have them. So, I don't see anything wrong with boards, but I do see a problem that if the boards do not meet the fiduciary responsibilities, and we have a college that is not being run efficiently or is having severe problems, who's going to be the oversight if the board is the problem? So that's the $64,000 question. In the bigs, you assume that they're big enough to handle, you know, that they're not going to get themselves in a real mess. Now, OHSU, when we cut them free, to be very honest, they overbonded for a while, and they were a problem. So I'm just trying to figure out a solution. If there is a problem, who's going to be the oversight? Because it really, by definition, is not the heck. So that's why, you know, under the current model with the chancellor, at least if there's a problem, there's someone that can step in and be objective, go down and try to make the changes that need to be made. So,
Representative Chair Buckley, Representative Gerard, I think that is an important point. I would say that there are several things that can and should occur. First, the boards are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. The individual board members can be removed by said governor and then be replaced. And so I do think that there is a check and balance along those lines. The second question of what happens if a university is being inefficiently run, and et cetera, one of the key things that I think we need to look at is the duties of the board itself to hire, fire, and evaluate the president. And I think that is a key responsibility of the boards themselves. And I think that when we look at the reason that Senate Bill 270 occurred is one of those very distinct questions in the way that the state responded in its answer. I also believe, and Chair Donegan and I've had discussions, and we had our discussion yesterday about the fiscal nature and the bonding capacity and whatnot. I do believe that there should be guardrails put in place. There could be caveats for institutional boards with regards to the fiscal performance and the financial performance, along with the performance to Senate Bill, to 40-40-20 on those measures, on certain limitations to what the board may or may not be able to exercise. I think there are logical answers in which we can address those. I'd also need to point out, and this is something that you probably don't want to hear, we live in a very interesting term in higher education that we go ebbs and flows. If we were having this discussion 3 years ago, we would be having and financing and fiscal and all that kind of good stuff, we would be having a very different discussion about my university specifically as well as Southern. If we were having this discussion 7 years ago, there would be a different university in that line. If we were having that discussion, I do believe, 10 years ago, one of the large universities would be in that line. And so there is an ebb and flow to this nature. And it is important that we look at what the longevity and the important, and looking forward 20 years, just as Member Henry mentioned, how do we impact 40-40-20? And a lot of it goes back to that decentralization and that effort to keep things local. This governor in particular, and over my 5 years here, have seen an amazing Jeffersonian democracy approach of handling tough issues. the regional solution centers, the RACs, the efforts to take on major projects and problems at the local level. I know in particular I'm working with environmentalists, logging industries, and civic groups and cultural groups on how best to log and timber moist forest. I never learned about moist forest until 2 years ago when I was made a convener of this group. And we've been able to take on those very, very difficult charges, very difficult issues at the local level and come up with very exciting solutions. This is another example of localized approach. Give the problem to the individuals who have to deal with it and say, come up with a solution. And to me, an institutional board is just that.
President, I'm going to take a chair's prerogative and add in here. I've been biting my lip a little bit, and I'm going to try to be as calm and as articulate as you have been in regard. And I need to emphasize the point that the President just made. Portland State at this point has a severe financial challenge. There's no discussion in this building that Portland State is inefficiently run. That's not been the brand or the accusation. To say that Southern Oregon has been inefficiently run, I reject that entirely. As the President said 8 years ago, it might have been a different institution we'd be talking about. And we'd be saying, was that institution inefficiently run? Or do we have some responsibility in this situation as well, in our disinvestment in higher education, which we have done for decades? The problems at SU are being addressed at a local level, including the faculty and the students and the community participating. And from my point of view, who would you rather have be the oversight of that process? Do you want that process to have oversight people in Portland who do not know the institution? Or do you want someone like Sid DeBoer, the CEO of Lithium Motors, who knows the region and knows business? Paul Nicholson, the executive director, former executive director of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, which we might agree is a fairly successful organization. Would you rather have those people? Rick Blyweiss, the CEO of Blackstone Audio, the largest audio book producer in the United States. Would you rather have those people overseeing that? Or would you rather have someone, and no offense to, I'll pick on Matt, no offense to Matt, or would you rather have Matt doing it from up north? To me, that's the question. I would rather have the people with the expertise and the passion for our institution overseeing that process rather than other people as well. And again, I really challenge any member of this chamber to sit down, go through the financials for all the institutions and check and look at the history of all the institutions. To brand SOU in a particularly negative light is something I simply can't accept as being accurate. And to mistake the idea that it was the somehow SOU in particular that caused a problem instead of all of us, including the current system of governance leading to where we are right now, we will get out of the hole that we're in, and we will get back onto a path of thriving. And I think the characterization is simply inaccurate. I had to respond, so I hope you'll indulge with my response.
Can I respond?
Sure.
I thought it was hypothetical.
Yeah. If you, a little sensitive, aren't you?
A little sensitive here.
Somebody, I was going to say, I'm glad you gave the dispassionate appeal there.
Yes, Senator Dimmer.
Thank you. Just a few questions. So in terms of the timeline, when we did Senate Bill 270, we projected, as President Weiss said, giving the regionals and technicals until July of 2015 to come forward with a request for a board or to indicate that they have decided to move forward with creating a board. There has been a lot of talk about that being too long of a timeline, and so there are some of us who are talking about shortening that until, moving it, shortening it by a year. I wonder if you could, address that. The purpose of shortening it is to provide more certainty so that we can figure out just where we're going, because, you know, obviously, if a couple of the TRUs form boards, then the idea of a consortium board for all four goes away. And the sooner we can know that, the better. So I wonder if you could address that.
Chair Buckley, Chair Gerard, Senator Denbrough, thank you very much. First and foremost, I think that the direct answer to your question, moving it from up 1 year, does make a lot of sense. Chair Donegan is leading a very robust effort to guide us and to help us and make informed decisions, and his leadership in that is needs to be commended, because it is a process that is full of a lot of twists and turns, and what one university does impacts another and everything else. And through this process, the four true presidents have worked very diligently together and are being proactive in that way. So again, using the process that Chair Donegan set forward provides us with a great deal of framework and benchmarks to meet, and we're on pace with that. So again, I appreciate his support there. Moving it up 1 year does make a lot of sense, and it's something that we, at least I seek. I can't speak for President Weiss, but I know in my discussions with President Maples and President Cullinan can answer for herself too, as she's in the room, I do believe. Clarity is very important, a direction of where we're moving. We are recruiting vice presidents, we're recruiting key administrators, we're recruiting faculty and whatnot, and governance is part of the discussion, and having at least some sense of clarity would be very, very important.
I'd like to respond to that as well. It's imperative that the uncertainty, the haze about governance be eliminated for two major reasons. One, our students who are selecting schools, are in schools, are in the universities, in programs, thinking about going to a university and wondering if a program is going to be there that they want to enter, wondering if the resources are going to be there to help them along. I think that the uncertainty just clouds that decision at the detriment of the true universities. So that has to, there must be some clarity. And two, the philanthropy for universities. I've gone to some significant donors recently to talk about contribution, philanthropy, naming a building for a building that we've been approved to build. And one of the concerns is, well, who will you be next year? Will you be the Monmouth campus of XYZ University, or will you be my alma mater? And this has hurt us, so there needs to be resolution.
Matt, or do you want to follow?
If I could, yes. Yeah. I actually have a couple. Thank you. I appreciate that, and I do agree with that position. So, Bob, your sense is that the timeline that the chair and the chancellor have put into place, which would have the State Board of Higher Ed prepared to, you know, review the decisions by the spring, that makes sense.
Chair Buckley, Chair Girard, Senator Dembrough, I'm looking to my chair. He's not in his head yet, so I agree with him.
Okay, great. One of the one of the elements that we looked at in terms of what we were expecting the Trues to do in coming to this decision was seek the advice of their communities, local, within the university. Students, faculty, staff, and then the external community. As Representative Whitsitt said, there has been a large amount of support from the external communities, at least at some of your schools. How about the faculty? Have they taken positions? The faculty obviously are sort of the more or less stable sector, within your university. They've been involved in its mission for decades. Where are they on this issue?
I'll answer first, and then Mark, that'd be fine. We have had robust discussions at multiple levels on our campus, and have done some specific surveys and whatnot. With regards, we've surveyed on three models: the consortium board model, the independent board model, and the quote unquote branch campus or the affiliate model. There is a clear preference for the consortium or the independence board. There's actually with our faculty very close on those two elements. When we've discussed the hybrid the true governance model. There's been very good support for that. There has been some also discussion about the support for an association with Oregon State University with significant caveats. So are the faculty are those that have many, many opinions and whatnot. I do not want to, our faculty senate has not taken an official vote or anything along those lines, but the faculty have voiced a lot of opinions in support of a consortium board or independent board and also the hybrid approach.
And just to follow up, do you expect, you know, before, you know, let's say in this spring you come forward with the decision to go for a board, do you expect your will you be asking your faculty for formal support of that decision?
We've had some discussions with the faculty senate chairperson about that, and right now they just prefer to voice their opinions and not necessarily have a formal vote per se. Other elements within the university have in fact made very specific requests or recommendations, advisory boards and those type of things.
Great.
So we have been talking of co-chairs committee. We've been talking about this all fall at our university with students, faculty, staff, alum, trustees, and community participation. We also issued a survey, and I'll report that our survey, which was very comprehensive with hundreds of responses, the desire to be a branch or affiliated campus was in the single digits, and the desire to either be a consortium or independent university, depending on, we asked the question two ways, and depending on how you asked the question, one or the other was the preference. I went to Faculty Senate 2 weeks ago. I asked them for a letter of support for their desired outcome, and they unanimously agreed that independent board was their conclusion. So they're drafting me a letter for my business plan package. The other divisions around the university faculty have issued me letters. We have in the room student body president Travis Mavison, ASWU, Western Oregon University student body president, who also has indicated very strong support for independent board for Western Oregon University, as have our Board of Trustees for the foundation, as have our local mayors. So we've done that homework, and we've gotten a unanimous response. May I have a nod of the head of Travis if that seems correct to you?
Give him a thumbs up.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. President. You know, it would really help me if we could have that kind of, you know, similar feedback from all your campuses.
Yeah. I would also, just real quickly, the survey report on our campus, too, had the branch campus at a single-digit response rate, and the, as I mentioned, the other one was split with faculty and staff. Students are unanimous, are very overwhelmingly preferred an institutional board.
And before I move to, I'll answer real quick, I had a forum with the Faculty Senate at SOU and other faculty members on Monday night. They had originally, under a survey, expressed interest in an affiliation. When it was explained, is the point that President Davis made, that there's no additional money that comes with affiliation, their interest in affiliation drops significantly. We will go back with the SOU faculty and get an official statement, but I can tell you from the meeting I had with approximately 60 faculty members, unless there was some sort of guaranteed boost to their budgets that gives them more to invest and build on their campus, the interest in affiliation drops hugely during that conversation. Mm-hmm. Matt, I'm sorry you've been waiting such a long time.
Oh, thank you. I have some comments, mostly in response to Senator Girard's question. Before doing so, I do feel some obligation to speak up on behalf of my board, and I certainly didn't take the previous comments by the co-chair personally, and I'm sure you didn't intend them that way. And I should also add that I'm personally a very strong advocate of decentralization. And having said that, I've seen tremendous value added by the Chancellor's staff and by my board. I think President Davies made reference to the Eastern Promise originating from, I think it was Dave Yaden. Mm-hmm. And so while the decentralization arguments, I think, are very persuasive and perhaps even compelling, I have to say that it would come at some loss of the contributions of some extraordinary volunteers and staff as well. Not to preordain any outcomes, but just to say there's a lot of value added from the Chancellor's office and the board. The main thing I want to say is, though, I think Senator Girard's question, opening question, is actually the very right question on this, which is really putting side by side the three alternatives, four perhaps, under consideration and asking what's the optimal one when it comes to accountability and oversight. I think that's really it. And I know while that might sound obvious, I think what is perhaps less obvious is the reason why we're able to ask that question is that I think a lot of the value of centralization, as both President Davies and President Weiss indicated, a lot of it's been accommodated by some of the recent changes here in Oregon. I mean, we need a statewide strategy on funding and on academic programs. If the heck wasn't up and actually looking pretty darn promising, I think you'd be very concerned about decentralization. The fact is, I think the heck is up, and coming up, and looks pretty promising. And talking to the national experts, they found that to be perhaps a game changer that enables further decentralization. Second is this shared services. A few months ago, it was nothing but a dream. And again, this is early stage and, you know, too early to call, but I think the progress has certainly exceeded my expectations. This I would share with you, Co-Chair Buckley. I think to a certain degree opens the floodgates for further look at decentralization. So then I think it does come back to the question Senator Girard's posing, which is when it comes to daily oversight and accountability of these universities, is that best provided by a local board, by a chancellor, or by a flagship university, if you will? And I think what AGB has said, and that's the national expert that we're relying on, is that, you know, there's no one-size-fits-all. If you look across the 50 states, most of it comes down to execution. Most of it comes down to people doing the right things on a daily basis, hiring and firing the right in the right mix and so forth. And so I think, again, that provides a lot more flexibility for us to consider. My feedback to the presidents, wearing this hat as well as the board hat, is I think the collaboration is very important. And so this president's council, I think, needs to get really built out and much better understood. And I would encourage you to invite the other big three universities and think beyond just simply a true council or body and something that facilitates collaboration more proactively with all seven universities. Because I think collaboration is one of those benefits of centralization that we ought not lose a small state like ours. So that's one. And the second one is, again, to compliment Senator Girard, I think the risk mitigation issue is important, which is, this all sounds good today on paper. What happens in the event of failure? I think we need to think that through. And it might not be anything that's within the control of the presidents or their local boards. It could be just simple demographics or markets. The economy comes roaring back. People leave college, go back to work. I mean, there are a lot of issues beyond our control. And should our models be too optimistic, which happens, we should have some sort of a safety net thought through. That's my own view, because I think, unlike the bigger three, the smaller universities have a smaller margin for error. And I think that makes risk mitigation and a safety net that much more important as you consider your proposal. So just to summarize, collaboration, I think, needs more work, and then also this risk mitigation.
Thank I think it's been an excellent discussion. I have to ask a quick kind of clarification question as well. Are the troop presidents ready, do you feel, that if there was time in the February session to consider moving forward and working with the state board to move forward to take some steps towards your model with instructions on what needs to be further defined, would the troop presidents be open and ready to engage in that so there would be a combined legislative and state board role in determining the future of the of this proposal?
I think we're at, Chair Buckley, Chair Gerard, that's a very interesting question, a very important question. I think we stand ready to serve our State Board of Higher Education. We stand ready to serve this legislative body. We are putting a lot of work behind it, and if we are instructed to do so, we will be ready.
I appreciate that comment. Senator Demo.
Just a final comment. I'm sitting here looking at what I believe is the oldest institution of higher education in the state through that window. But, I mean, it's not that large. It actually obviously has a different structure. It's private. You know, its students do get public or both state and federal aid. It doesn't get broad public support, and obviously the support is probably less than it should have been from the state for our public universities. But I don't see any reason why a university of 4,000 or 5,000 or even 3,000 can't flourish, particularly if we're doing appropriately what we should be doing here at the state, and particularly if it has a support base in its own region where it's located.
Well said. Well said. Senator Deverill, would you like to?
Yeah, just, and I very much agree with what Senator Devlin said, and that was, you know, frankly, when we were developing the end stages of Senate Bill 270, and you and I were working closely on that, that was our assumption, was that we wanted to allow for a path if the smaller universities felt they needed a board, or they wanted to go that route, there was a path for them to go that route. There would still be, you know, we felt it was important for there to be a role for the State Board of Higher Ed to, you know, assess that and to advise us on, you know, on that path. But I think that there's not really anything we need to do legislatively in February other than to shorten that window, you know, from July 2015 to July 2014. Otherwise, you know, everything I think is already in place in Senate Bill 270 to allow universities to move forward and, you know, make their decision, indicate their decision to the State Board of Higher Ed. State Board of Higher Ed would then, you know, give their consent or not. I mean, obviously, if the State Board of Higher Ed feels that there are compelling reasons not to endorse that decision, there are going to have to be some conversations around that. But, you know, I would assume that's only going to happen if there are, you know, serious reasons to do that. And, you know, I think that's important for us to, you know, to be able to rely on that. So I do think that the only thing we really need to do, as far as I can tell, is to shorten that timeline to make sure that, you know, come summer, we know where we're headed. As the Chancellor's office moves into, you know, the next year, they're going to have certainty about what they need to do during that next year, which is so important to them.
Jenny, please.
Chair, I would support Senator Dembrell's suggestion here, in particular because of, as have been referred to by our presidents, there's a lot going on in rural education right now, and questions about are we able to provide the kind of support for that education, and again, I'm the 40-40-20 cheerleader. Are we going to be able to provide support for that? I think the sooner we know about what happens next, I think the sooner we are able to coordinate the kinds of work that we want to do together. And so I believe that the suggestions that have come forward are critical suggestions, they're important suggestions, and I believe that in your own wisdom, since you are legislators and I am not, that moving that up would be significantly important. And I also speak as the chair of the State Board of Education, where other pre-K through 12 institutions and would like to know what's going to happen.
Thank you. I appreciate those comments. I'd just like to say, just based off of Senator Devlin's comments, too, just to note that some of our institutions, that they've been around for decade after decade after decade. How old is Eastern?
We started in 1929.
1929.
Opened the door on October 28th, 1929. Another day that was in infancy.
1856.
1856. Dr. Cullinan?
1872.
1842. I think it's important to note that we're not talking about institutions that are on the verge of collapse. We're talking about what's the best way to move forward. Speaking on behalf of the House, and I think an informal poll and discussions with House leadership, the House is ready to move forward to clarify the situation and support the President's proposals. And totally willing to have the State Board process play it all the way out. I think the one concern from the advocates for the truths is, what if the State Board says no to the President's proposals? We're left in this limbo state, and that's a question that's unclear to us. And, I think some of the concern is, what if the State Board, I'm being very careful what I'm saying here, what if the State Board decides, well, in their judgment, one university, yes, will get its State Board, but then the consortium idea, as you've mentioned, Senator, is gone. So where are we then? So I think, at least from the House side, and please correct me if I'm wrong, any of my House colleagues, and I've talked to Representative Smith about this as well, from the House side, our desire is to move forward, is to get this resolved, but have clarity about what the possible consequences are of the different choices that are made along the way. I think we'd be comfortable having some sort of decision made in February that would at least show that the legislature is in support of this proposal, so at least the State Board has the information if we don't change statute. This committee can do that if this committee gets to a comfort level of making a recommendation or a suggestion. So I just want to get that on the table. That's one of the concerns that we have about shortening the timeline, is that if there's something that comes up, we would like to have the opportunity to address it. We'd like to have the opportunity to do so. Did you want to comment on that, Matt? Did you raise your hand?
Thank you, Co-Chair Buckley. And I would just add to that there's certainly the uncertainty of the vote, and at this point there has been very scant discussion at the full board level of this. This has remained at the work group level, and so in terms of but there will be robust discussion between now and April. I think we're shooting for an April vote, more probably, at the board meeting. So we'll bring the full board up to speed. And so I do want to assure the committee that the board stands fully ready to fulfill its responsibilities. Having said that, it's my understanding anyway that the tools at our disposal are fairly limited. It's an up or down vote. So a lot of the nuance that we have discussed here even today, in terms of Senator Girard's comments around, what happens in the event of failure, we have no ability to address that, other than perhaps some sort of a report to this group, nor do we have the ability to provide any kind of financial tests or parameters or anything along those lines. So, from our standpoint, we're fully prepared to deliver an up or down vote at the board level. I struggle to see any scenario where that will be sufficient. I think there will have to be some complementary action taken by the legislature in order to fulfill whatever, vote that we would take.
Thank you.
And whether that's done February, as you're suggesting, or would wait until a subsequent session, that's why I raise it.
If there's a piece that could be done in February, I'm not quite sure what that would be.
Senator Rod.
We have two chambers. And
no, I understand that.
The Senate, we tend to be a little slower.
Contemplative.
Yes. We'd like to think things out. 270 was kind of rushed through, and we've paid a price for doing something that we probably should have figured out a few more things, especially on shared services. I think would have worked out better for the troops. So I don't see a problem with giving the chancellor a chance to go work her magic and then come back and deal with the thing in 2015. So, my personal opinion is I think time isn't of the essence, and that we can wait until 2015, get the bill the way that it should be drafted, work out the problems if there is a failure. We have to somewhere deal with if there is a failure with the boards, who are we going to bring in? You can talk about somebody that runs Shell Corporation, but they don't deal with higher ed. You have a professional in the chancellor. Mm-hmm. So, you're going to have to have a troubleshooter somewhere. Either the heck is going to have to take over that responsibility, or you keep the chancellor on and she maintains that function. It's not one of those things in a bloody 30-day session that we can get through. So it isn't that it's a bad idea. I'm not saying it's a bad idea. I just think that we have to work through the questions that we have and work with the State Board of Higher Ed and work with the chancellor and see if we can come up with something that can be generated in 2015.
And I'm not in disagreement of that. And when I say the House is ready to act, I think the House is ready to support, similar to we just nodded our head on the shared services approach.
Well, shared
the
House services, nodded our head. Shared services isn't
but
a problem.
The House is ready to nod our head on the President's proposal to be developed, for the work to continue on that, and to show that we are supportive of the choices made by the four regional presidents speaking on behalf of their institutions and their communities. That's what all the House is saying, is we're ready to give the nod, please continue on with that work, and let's figure out how to best do that during February, during the spring, and during 2015. The clarity question's been brought up. The clarity question, I think, deserves a response to it as well. I think we're capable of doing that. I think we're capable of getting the desire of small sides addressed, and I would like to continue to do that work.
I'd just like to get a clarification, though, because I wasn't involved as directly as you or you in the underlying bill that started all of this. My understanding right now is that the shared service is going to have to be done regardless.
Right.
There doesn't seem to be a lot of disagreement on this committee about the shared services model. There may be issues. The State Board of Higher Education already has the authority to say whether the TRUs get independent boards. Now, there may be a clarification in statute that's needed, but some of that thing about some certainty, you might get to a point, and of course there is this potential that you might say to one of the regionals, no, but I think in a lot of ways, if you're going to take an action in April, a lot of this is going to come together. Now, whether you still need some clarification in statute, I don't know if that's necessary, prior to 2015, just to simply a clarification in statute. I could see if it was necessary in terms of some matter in terms of bonding or something like that, but I don't anticipate that being the issue. But that's where I'm thinking we are right now.
Senator, I would agree. I don't think that the idea of the boards for the TRUs would start anytime sooner than July 1st of 2015. The 2015 session would be there to try to resolve any problems.
But absent affirmative action by the legislature to do something differently, if there's already authority for them to have boards, if the Board of Higher Education gives them that, they would already have that degree of certainty, not every detail. I said something to Senator Hansel I maybe shouldn't repeat, but if one of the institutions for some reason or not did have a huge problem, I fully anticipate they would be here.
Yeah.
I actually fully anticipate they would be here, and we would be trying to address whatever problem they had.
And that goes for any of the institutions?
Yeah, that goes for any of the institutions, all seven.
So, sorry, I think the only, and I don't want to keep going, well, I only are past one. And my appreciation for your indulgence, the I think from the TRUE's point of view, to the decision to grant boards to the larger three institutions was made by the legislature. The legislature, the best compromise we could get to move forward with 270 was to put forward the process for bringing forth. I'm comfortable with the process being forth. I'm hoping it's a collaborative process of bringing forth. But we have a chip on our shoulders in Southern Oregon and in Eastern Oregon, in a sense that we want to make sure that our voices are heard. We want to make sure that we have the same opportunities that Portland State has. I mean, that's my constituents will say to me, why don't we get the same respect and consideration that Portland State? And it's hard for me to answer that and
both
say...
Both have just about as good football teams.
Yeah, that is actually, no, I would say our football team was in the top 20 this year. Anyway,
Senator, I'm not sure you want to go there.
I won't continue the conversation any further, but just glad, I appreciate the chance to get this on the record, gentlemen. And Dr. Cullinan, on behalf of your colleagues, thank you so much for your incredible efforts and your staff's efforts on this very difficult subject. And members of this committee, thank you for your time and your indulgence.
Thank you.